Clean charged 25 leaders, members, and associates of the Aryan Brotherhood with a host of crimes. Most significantly, the criminal complaint includes an allegation of a violation of the federal RICO statute. Predicate criminal acts alleged in support of the RICO violation include 5 murders, conspiracies to commit 4 other murders, and a large-scale interstate trafficking operation involving methamphetamine and other drugs.
U.S. Attorney McGregor W. Scott announcing federal charges against the Aryan Brotherhood. The feds indicted 16 people, mostly prison inmates, on allegations of racketeering, murder, and drug trafficking, among others. 9 others had already been charged. Yesterday's indictment stems from a 5-year investigation that spanned some of California's most secure prisons. Joining us to talk about this is Brian Levin. He's director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Hi, Brian.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So why now? I mean, the Aryan Brotherhood, it's known to operate in the state's prison system. So why are the feds bringing these charges now?
Well, you know, great question. And here's the thing. You know, when you have a homicide like that that's so brazen, you're going to bring attention to what you're doing. And what happens is, during the course of investigations, witnesses and evidence gets rolled up and it leads up a hierarchy. And there might have very well been another RICO investigation going on at the same time, and these kind of merged. We'll find much more out during the trial. But the bottom line is, RICO is a federal statute that was put into place to stop these organized crime syndicates that had a pattern of criminality. So it was something that really was designed to get these larger criminal syndicates through a series of activities that were furthering the criminal enterprise. And boy, was there a list there, everything from contraband and drugs to homicide.
Right.
So that's kind of what they're doing, and they rolled up quite a few people.
Right, and I remember my Al Capone history, where it all started with RICO. And part of the charges, as you say, include smuggling all sorts of things, including batteries and cell phones into the prisons. And officials say that the gang members were essentially just running the show from inside. So how did that operation work?
In recent years, there's been a bit of turnover with some of the leadership, for instance. And what happens is you have people jockeying for positions, but it's also a violent organization, and it in order to maintain order within its ranks, it enforces violence, oftentimes to outsiders, but sometimes even to people who go rogue. Interestingly enough, an unrelated group, and people get them confused, the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, they're really bad. They're a totally different organization, and they actually kill more of their members than outsiders. I don't think our Aryan Brotherhood, which started up in the Bay Area, San Quentin, in about 1964, is quite as bad with their membership. But these are violent enterprises, and they enforce a code of conduct not only within the organization, but but outside, within the prison, and then outside prison walls as well, as we've seen.
Well, allegedly, an Orange County lawyer smuggled phones and things like batteries into the prison for them in Little Debbie cakes. And allegedly, also 2 of the inmates, Ronald Yandel and Daniel Troxell, were sort of ringleaders of this whole organization, and they sat on a small council of people running the show. Can you tell us any more about these 2 men?
Well, these folks are long time criminals, and the bottom line is, we've seen in one of these cases, basically the Shiv killing of a fellow inmate in front of a whole bunch of people, including the prison guards, who had to use tear gas to try to stop the murder. Initially, they listen to this. You not only have contraband drugs and phones being brought into the prison, but if people are unsuccessful, these leaders will enforce not only violence against people who go up against them, but there's also the issue of enforcing, sometimes through the use of violence, those who don't fulfill their obligations. And one of the things that happened is a terrible thing. The victim, folks thought he was just being punched, and these folks had shivs. So what it looks like is there was like a whole degree of resources that these folks were controlling, whether it was communication through cell phones, which you are just not allowed to have in our state prison system, also drugs, but also weaponry as well. And they're so adept with these resources that they also have the personnel who will actually go out and enforce, including in front of everyone in a yard, the murder of another inmate.
Well, let me ask you this. The Aryan Brotherhood, it got its start inside San Quentin State Prison, and it's just north of San Francisco. So why has the prison system, particularly California's prison system, been such a breeding ground for this organization?
Well, great question. Couple of reasons. It's an excellent question. During the 60s, there was a change with regard to hate in America. So we saw like these Aryan and Nazi movements really bubble up beyond the traditional Klan. And one of the places they naturally would bubble up is in a place where the Klan didn't have a presence, like the prisons, which were already fairly racially segregated. They've been so for some time. But what had happened was, around the 60s, there was a growing anti-establishment movements. There were also movements around ethnicity, and these were amplified within prisons, where people would join not just because of some kind of pride, which they might have been impactful, but also for self-protection. And what ended up as, at the same time that this awareness was going on, we saw a significant increase in crime in the prison population. So in other words, a whole bunch of factors going from cultural to the fact that there was a growth in crime. And what else? In California, what happened during the 1960s? Well, California became the biggest state population-wide around that time. So we, with the growth and diversity of the population, an increase in criminality, and also a focused attention on identity, as well as these organizational mechanisms within prisons, we saw a perfect storm to have these kind of criminal syndicates, and now they exist all over the country.
Well, now what's their primary motivation? I mean, is it still about race, or is at this point less about that and more about just this business of drug trafficking?
Great question. You know what I always say? Evil doesn't come in a hermetically sealed bag. And what I'm saying is, I would tell you, bottom line is, for these guys, I think the criminality actually comes first. That doesn't mean that they're choir boys and I think they're like tolerant people. But what I'm saying is, what we've seen, and it's really interesting, sometimes you'll have truces brokered, or even with various different criminal Aryan syndicates, which also includes outside biker gangs and other groups. We had Public Enemy Number One, for example, which exists also outside of the prisons. It ain't personal. Most of the time, it's business. So they'll kill a competitor who's of the same race and might strike a truce with someone of a different race just to get business done. But bottom line is, they're dangerous. And one of the things that we've seen, and this is interesting, just bear with me. Our friends at the ADL put out a really interesting document on what they call extremist-related killings. But only a portion of them are ideologically motivated. So what we see is, within this subculture of Nazis and also the subcultures of prisons, when they merge, they're incredibly violent. So when we count our data, we just look at ideological motivated murders, but our friends at ADL look at all kinds of murders by these hardcore people, these hardcore Nazis, both in and outside the prison, and these folks are incredibly violent people.
Well, Brian, thanks for catching us up on this.
Thank you so much for having me. Can I just say one thing? Thank you so much, Public Radio, for all the great things you do across the country.
Oh, well, thanks for that prop. Brian Levin, he's director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. coming up. Now L.A. has even more stars, the Michelin kind. But do the restaurants that Michelin singled out really represent the best L.A. has to offer? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven from Madeline Brand. Don't we have enough stars in L.A. already? Do we really need Michelin ones? Since 2010, the prestigious Michelin Guides has chosen not to give any of its coveted top ratings to any restaurants in Los Angeles, or Southern California for that matter. The then director of Michelin Guides justified abandoning L.A. by saying, quote, "The people in Los Angeles are not real foodies. They are not too interested in eating well, but just in who goes to which restaurant and where they sit." Well, if that was ever true, and I'm not sure it ever was, a lot has changed since then. This year, 24 restaurants in L.A. received stars. Some chefs and restaurant goers are celebrating the return of Michelin's favor. Others, not so much at all. Here to sort it out is Matthew Kang. He's the editor of Eater L.A., and it's great to talk with you again.
Hi.
So where are you on that continuum? How are you feeling about the end of this Michelin snub and the restaurants that they chose to single out?
I mean, I think overall the Michelin Guide is a bonus for LA because it kind of puts the city's dining scene on par with other great international dining cities like New York City and Paris and Tokyo. But ultimately, I think the guide is not for Angelinos. It's not for people that live here, that work here, that come here regularly. I think it's for tourists, people who don't necessarily consider the restaurants when they come to Los Angeles. And now they have like just a quick and easy guide to go like, where should I eat? Where should I go?
Right. And I always thought of it as something for out-of-towners. And we're going to talk about that in a minute in the history. But how about this list? You know, places like Providence and Orizawa and Vespertine, they got 2 stars. And I think like three sushi restaurants maybe got in that top ranking out of 6 restaurants. So it's just not a list in the spirit of Jonathan Gold or what I think of as LA's food scene, you know, authentic flavors from all over the world.
I mean, one thing to know is that Michelin is from Europe. It's not a local guide. It's not compiled by people who live here and understand the breadth and the depth of LA's culinary scene. It's sort of an outsider's perspective by nature. And so the restaurants that are going to feature, I mean, by and large, they're going to be fancy tasting menu, places where you celebrate, places where you can splurge, very expensive. And they're usually like sort of a Eurocentric or a Japanese heavy perspective. So obviously they love sushi. They love omakase, kaiseki type restaurants. That's why Ennaka got 2 stars and Hayato, which is a fairly new restaurant, like only 8 or 9 seats in downtown LA, places like that. Where, you know, there's just such attention to detail, there's an intricacy, and it really leaves out places that Angelinos love, Korean restaurants, Thai restaurants, Mexican restaurants, almost completely overlooked. The only Mexican restaurant notably that was on the guide in Southern California is Taco Maria, which is in Orange County. So it's just sort of this, We know food. These are the places that we think are good, but I think the average Angelino is going to be like, well, I think you missed a lot.
Right. And it has that helicoptered in feel. Who are these judges? And they're anonymous, right?
Yeah. So the Michelin inspector is this sort of mystical figure that's been discussed and investigated for years. But yeah, generally they are anonymous. They are always either single or maybe they come in pairs or they have one other diner. They're supposed to be under the radar, completely unknown to restaurateurs and chefs. And I think in L.A., there's a crazy article in Le Monde, which is a French publication, following a Michelin inspector in Los Angeles. And in this article, I've read some excerpts of it, you can see this. It's the first time a journalist ever followed along with the Michelin inspector while they were dining in restaurants like Vespertine and Rustic Canyon. And you get an inside look, like, what do they do? I mean, this inspector was going to the bathroom during the meal at Vespertine to take notes. So they went to the bathroom like multiple times, and it's just so strange and unusual.
What fun, though. I would have loved to have run into some guy in a black suit and a narrow tie making notes in the, well, sorry, I would not have gone in the men's room.
You wouldn't see them in the bathroom, but maybe you'd see them go, why is that guy going to the bathroom like 19 times during this meal?
All right. So if Michelin didn't think of L.A. as a food city 10 years ago, you know, what's changed, L.A. or Michelin?
I think L.A. has changed. 10 years ago is about the time that I started covering restaurants professionally. And I think the casual nature, the kind of more relaxed vibe of L.A. restaurants hasn't changed. But I think what has changed is that the intricacy, the execution, the finesse of the cooking has definitely improved. And Michelin was probably looking at LA's dining scene thinking, you know what? I think we need to be there. We need to cover what's happening in Los Angeles because there's some great food happening. Angelinos, on the other hand, are like, look, we know we've been good. We know the product has been amazing. Michelin needed to be in Los Angeles. And I don't think LA needed Michelin, but I think Michelin needed LA.
So we were saying it's Michelin's more of a restaurant guide for tourists. And it started that way, right? By the tire company?
Correct. So the Michelin Guide started in, I believe, the early 1900s. And literally, it was a tire company that wanted to get people on the road and using their tires. And how do you do that? Well, they set up a guide throughout Europe, mainly in France, saying this is a restaurant that's worth a detour. This is a restaurant that's worth its own journey. And that got people out driving and going out to the countryside. And it really spotlighted these rural restaurants or like wine country restaurants. And so a single star is a restaurant that's very good in its category. A two star is worth a detour. And three stars is a restaurant that's worth its own journey. And those are sort of like how you put into perspective what stars actually mean.
It's practically, you know, guide by mileage, right?
Yeah, I mean, they want you to get out there, use your tires, and travel.
L.A. didn't get any three-star restaurants, which is ironic, given that you travel far to get to any restaurant in L.A., it feels like.
That's true. Yeah, every restaurant in L.A. is its own journey. But, you know, I think the reason why they didn't award three stars this year is because the guide tends not to start out in a city awarding three stars. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that they want chefs to sort of like earn that third star. They're not just going to come out of the gate and be like, Vespertine is a three-star restaurant, even though I truly believe that over time it will be. So what that means is that the Michelin guide is going to start out even at a city's highest restaurants at two, and then allow that restaurant to earn that third star. I think what that does is it gives everyone a little extra motivation in the city of Los Angeles, whether you're a one-star, two-star, to be like, you know what, I want to get to that next level.
Okay, last thought, and it's a two-parter. A restaurant that's on the list that you think it's really doesn't deserve it, and a restaurant that should be on the list, either a one-star or a two-star.
Oh, man, that is I do not plan on throwing any shade to any restaurant on that list. A restaurant that I think didn't make the list that should have been, I think there should have been a Korean restaurant on there. Koreatown, I'm Korean-American. I love the Korean food in the city. I think that there are at least four or five restaurants that should have made the list, including Park's Barbecue and Soban, and I really hope the Michelin Guide looks at them in next year's round.
I am right there with you. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Matthew Kang is the editor of Eater LA. coming up. The last X-Men movie is here. Will it end the franchise on a satisfying note?
I wish, if anything, they had just gone full throttle and just killed them all, which maybe they do, knowing that this is the last of it.
Our critics weigh in on Dark Phoenix and other new releases. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, and it is Friday. Time to talk movies. Hooray. This time around, Roth Cornett is here. She is editor-in-chief at Screen Junkies / Fandom. And Mark Jordan Ligon also joins us. He's a TV writer and film historian and co-host of the podcast Film Freaks Forever. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure. We're going to start with this ominous title, I Am Mother. And it's a Netflix original starring Rose Byrne, Hilary Swank, and Clara Rugard.
Why aren't there any more children, Mother?
There used to be.
Then why did you only make one?
Mothers need time to learn. This facility was designed to give humanity a second chance. One that began with you. Daughter.
So this is clearly a rom-com.
Yes.
Wildly funny. With a robot.
It's a lighthearted romp set in our post-apocalyptic world after the robot uprising. Is what I took away from that.
A extinction event has taken place. These are familiar tropes in science fiction. It is a chamber piece. It's a contained environment with three characters. It will immediately have people thinking of some familiar sci-fi fare that the paranoia a little bit of the thing in which and more recently Ex Machina, where the protagonist
is a fantastic film from Alex Garland.
And this unfortunately doesn't really have the heft or the depth or the style of Ex Machina. Thematically, there are some opportunities there. Again, it's this idea of humanity is the architect of its own destruction, which is quite familiar. I actually grow a little weary of that because we're never really offered a solution. It's just kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in our actual world at this point.
Yes, and we've seen it a lot. The robots are always winning.
They sure do. Well, and they would, right? But inevitably, and it's also interestingly to me, I think a little bit about the depth of our desire to personify, where we can't, you know, you give a robot a very nice voice and suddenly you can't distinguish between human and robot anymore.
Well, that was my question. The mother is a robot or is it a human on a lot of Valium?
It's a robot played by Rose Byrne. The thing that is in this film that I thought was thematically interesting and fresh to some degree was that it does offer a solution. It's just not the solution you would want, right? And so there's also this idea in science fiction that if you give AI akin to a human desire or emotion, be it love or admiration, they will take it to a level that humans don't. And they will misinterpret the outcome of that emotion, which is what happens here very much to the nth degree. But the solution is probably one we've all thought about for human beings, which is that we need to be the better versions of ourselves and raise our young to be the better versions of themselves. But it then plays on the idea of parental expectations, the devouring mother, quite literally in some cases.
Right, which is also so old. It's always the mothers who get beaten up.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure some of our listeners can relate
Freud?
To a robot as a mom. Maybe they had a few moms that were cold and mechanical. Growing up. But, you know, it's funny. I thought the young actress, Clara Rugard, I thought she gave a very good performance, very strong performance. You know, when Hilary Swank shows up, you know, she's doing her kind of her best Linda Hamilton impersonation, you know, just a strong survivor. Because as you said, there's a lot of other movie tropes that are in here. Terminator, iRobot, AI, all that stuff. It just, I just felt it was almost a little overwhelmed with all of their ideas that they were trying to get across. And in the long run, I just felt the script kind of failed that way.
I agree. It was thin. And it's too
bad. It looks great.
It looks good. There's interesting.
Well,
right. And aesthetics go a long way in sci-fi.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
Well, okay, moving on to a film that is very much set in the present, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And this film is loosely based on a true story about two San Francisco natives. It's directed by Joe Talbot.
Maybe he's right. What if we shouldn't be here? Well, we should be here more.
Some millionaire?
Not your loss. That's San Francisco.
I don't know how much longer we can keep doing this. But I'm not leaving. I'm the last one left.
This movie has a lot of buzz. Mark, you've seen this.
Yes.
Give us a little background on it.
Well, the background's fascinating because the star and co-writer Jimmy Fails grew up in San Francisco with the first-time director and co-writer Joe Talbot. They've known each other since they were little kids, and they have been trying to get this thing made for years. They started a Kickstarter campaign for it 5 years ago.
It's a real passion project.
Yes, and you know this—it's a touching, heartfelt film, and I really think it deserves to be seen. You know, it has an unusual combination of dreamlike sequences and raw reality, and it works. And the opening scene is so stylized that it reminded me a lot of a young Spike Lee, and I mean that, you know, as a compliment. And the performances are top-notch. Jimmy Fails and Jonathan Majors, who plays his best friend, they just feel the both of them are just, they're unique and creative and sensitive, so they don't really fit in with their neighborhood group, and they're just really kind of looking for a home. But I just thought it was just this powerful, sad, funny, beautiful take on gentrification. It absolutely really hits that home, and I highly recommend this film.
And what's the storyline? It's
basically Jimmy Fails plays like a third generation African American, and that he is obsessed with a house he claims his grandfather built. But of course, with the way real estate prices are in the Bay Area, the family lost the house a long time ago, and now like only a millionaire could afford it. But Jimmy's character is obsessed with trying to get it back into the family's hands.
Huh. And it looks great.
It looks great.
Joe Talbot won a jury prize at Sundance for Best Direction.
Yes, and it's his feature film debut, and it's beautiful and well worth seeing.
Okay, full-throated endorsement here. So let's end with a big release this weekend, Dark Phoenix. It's the 12th installment in the X-Men film series, starring Sophie Turner.
Something's happening to me.
When I lose control, bad things happen.
But it feels good.
Okay, this is where Lady Sansa Stark of Winterfell, a.k.a. Queen of the North, really breaks bad.
Yes, this is the rise of Dark Sansa. It's, you know, it's funny because this is from director Simon Kinberg, who has written extensively on the X-Men films, also Star Wars, and produced extensively on X-Men. And this is the first time he's directing, and he doesn't appear to be entirely up to the task. And I will say this, the last film, Apocalypse, was a wild mess. And this one, sadly, was not enough of a train wreck. It was really
like there is a train wreck.
There is a train wreck, but it's really, really inert. It's quite safe, too safe. It has no teeth. And that's especially sad given that this is likely the last in this iteration of the franchise.
Right. This could end it all.
This will end it all because Disney has purchased Fox and they will absolutely do what they want. Marvel Studios will now take over. Kevin Feige will now have the task of reintroducing the X-Men with the Marvel cinematic characters that we've known from Marvel Studios. But the big tragedy about this for me is that Dark Phoenix is a storyline that comic fans have wanted to see adapted for a very long time. It was done not well in the third X-Men film, Last Stand. Mm-hmm. And it was done not well again here. And I think the very, very sad part of that is that Sophie Turner's character, Jean Grey, she is completely without agency for the bulk of this film. And it's really, really sad.
Well, yeah. I mean, here there was a chance to treat the female leads with respect.
Yes.
And to, you know, this is a pure attempt to pass the Bechdel test.
Yes.
Right. and empower them, but you're saying
it is utterly pointless.
Yes.
And then you have someone like Jessica Chastain, and you can utterly waste her as well.
She's
as an entirely
wasted.
Arch one-dimensional, not even two-dimensional villain. And I think I could handle it being a going out with a poof rather than a bang, the X-Men. But that's the piece of this that I think makes me a little bit mad. Because Jean Grey deserved better than that as
yes,
a character.
It's as you said, it's just completely tired and underwhelming. And listen, I'm sorry to be a stickler for facts, but in the opening scene, right?
Yes.
They take the time to say 1975. We're seeing Jean Grey as a young girl in the backseat of her parents' car. So if they take the time to tell us it's 1975 and she's sitting in the backseat of the car with her parents and they're driving and an old Glen Campbell song is playing on the radio.
Oh.
And Jean Grey uses her mind to change the station. And then we hear Werewolves of London. And
what?
Then the mom changes it back.
Even I know
yes,
that's not
I'm
right.
sorry. Warren Zevon's song did not come out till 1978. And it's just like, how hard would that have
I
been to
fact check? I wish an anachronism was the least of its problems.
But also, I guess Jean Grey also has the power with her mind to predict top 40 hits 3 years into the future.
That's what she uses her power for.
I wish that had been the B-plot of this movie instead of what they went with.
And it's just, frankly, it's poorly directed action,
yes.
Which is surprising. And
they reshot the finale.
And they reshot the finale because when you have things like superheroes, which I happen to really enjoy.
Yes,
I'm a fan
and
I've
liked
genre.
A lot of the X-Men films. That's, I think, why I was so disappointed in this one.
But if you're not directing them well, it looks very silly.
So even the reshot finale is not satisfying?
My strong guess is that Marvel came in and perhaps it was a little bit more of a mess the way Apocalypse was, and they made it more coherent. But also, that is my guess, and I could be wrong. But it's very, very, very safe. And I wish, if anything, they had just gone full throttle and just killed them all, which maybe they do. Knowing that this is the last of it, you know?
Okay, well, I hesitate to ask this since it sounds like I can't imagine who would go after listening to this these comments, but if you haven't gone to the X-Men movies, will you even understand what's going on in this film?
I don't think so.
I don't think you'll care. I don't even think it's that you won't understand. I think Marvel Studios probably has a little bit more of that problem, where if you tried to go in to see Endgame, it would be incredibly confusing if you weren't up to speed. But this film more has the problem that even if you do know, you just don't care about these characters because they're not behaving like themselves. They are completely and utterly driven by the plot needs and change. Magneto in this film makes absolutely no sense. And Magneto is one of the most interesting of the X-Men characters.
Yes. And because they knew it was the last one, don't you agree? They crowbar everybody in.
Yes.
It's almost like one of those variety
shows.
Why is
Magneto even there?
Like, hey, Storm, you remember Storm. Yeah. And look, it's Nightcrawler, you nut.
Yeah. Like an anniversary show.
Yes.
Well, a weekend to maybe do some laundry, wash your hair,
and
celebrate
the last
National
Black
Donut
Man in San Francisco.
And
yeah, the one good film
there
that
you
I
go.
Didn't see.
Well, thank you so much, you guys. This is great talking with you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Mark Jordan Lean is a TV writer and film historian, and Roth Cornett, editor in chief for Screen Junkies News. Coming up, one of America's most well-known directors takes on one of the world's greatest opera singers, Ron Howard, on his new documentary, Pavarotti. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. And that is Luciano Pavarotti, arguably the best tenor of all time. He was also a rock star. He teamed up with Bono, Sting, Mariah Carey to bring opera to the masses. And, of course, there were the three tenors.
Hey!
Pavarotti, along with Jose Carreras and Placido Domingo, sold out stadiums and became the hottest band of the 90s. Pavarotti died from pancreatic cancer in 2007. Director Ron Howard has a new documentary about him called Simply Pavarotti. And Madeline sat down to talk about it with Ron Howard recently.
You are a lifelong opera fan, or how did you come to do a movie about that?
You know, well, when I was 4 years old, I'd made my first movie, and it happened to be in Vienna, Austria. And my parents, who were actors, young, struggling actors from Oklahoma, thought, well, while we're over here, I guess we ought to take them to the opera. So I actually do remember here a moment where the soprano is belts out an unbelievable note in this beautiful dress, and everybody gives her a big ovation. That's my first encounter with opera. Not a fan though. Over the years, mostly seen on television. I've appreciated, but never fully understood. And I think that might be one of the things that really attracted me to this subject. Not only is he an incredibly charismatic figure who is both earthy and relatable, and at the same time, of course, this outlier figure, this remarkable talent. But he existed within a world that was fascinating and alien to me, and I liked that sort of thing. For example, I didn't know anything about going to the moon before we made the movie Apollo 13, or I knew nothing about Formula One before I directed the movie Rush. So I like characters who fascinate me, that who exist in worlds, are tested by worlds that I don't know much about, and I think other people, may not know a lot about as well. And I like exploring it and sharing what I can learn.
Right, and so even though Pavarotti was so popular and probably the best known opera singer in the world, it is remarkable how little we all know about him. Whereas we know pretty much every single detail of Elvis's life, for example.
Right.
But
or the Beatles. I did a documentary a couple of years ago, The Beatles 8 Days a Week. And there, almost everybody knew almost everything about them. In this case, here's a household name. A medium, opera, that people are well aware of, probably have a lot of respect for, but generally not as well known. I thought that was a great creative opportunity.
So let's talk about his origins. He grew up in Modena, Italy, and his father was a working class guy, right? He was a baker. And
right.
I thought it was really sweet that Pavarotti says that his dad was a better singer than he.
Yeah, I mean, and that we with documentaries, I've learned that you sort of can only bring to the screen that which kind of comes to you in the form of either an interview or footage that you can find. And in some accounts said that his father was plagued by stage fright. No one said that to us. We couldn't confirm that. So, it's not in the movie. But for some reason, he couldn't make a career of it. Of course, you're talking about a pretty devastated post-war Italy, a small village. And, and young Pavarotti experienced all of that, traumatizing images of that time when he was very, very young. His father's coming out of that. So Pavarotti definitely, he's got something in his DNA, but he was not a prodigy. And he was, he did some singing. He sang with his father and so forth and seemed to have an aptitude, but he had a career as an elementary school teacher. Opera was not going to be his life. And his mother, let's hear it from mom, stepped up and said, no, you do have something special and you have to pursue it.
Can you tell us why he is so great? As you say, his mother said, you've got something, you need to pursue this. What was it that he had that other people don't have?
Well, technically, I can't begin to explain it. Although I did become fascinated by what's required to make those sounds and to achieve it. And it turns out, it's sort of a feat of athleticism in a way. So not only are they expressing these emotional ideas through and performing them, but they're also they're also making their bodies do something that's far, far from natural, and not that many people can achieve it, you know, anyway. But in order to achieve it, even if you have the capability, the training is incredible. I keep likening it to, you know, the first time that you saw Michael Jordan take off at the free throw line and slam dunk, you said, oh my God, I didn't know human beings could actually do that. Well, I came to understand that that's really the way we should feel about the way great opera singers can perform. So he had that. He achieved all of that. On top of everything else, he's just wildly charismatic. He was a great ambassador for opera. When, you know, you'd see him on a talk show, talking about it, you could recognize his enthusiasm for it, his passion for it. And he was incredibly winning. He was funny. So our film also has the benefit of all of that.
Right. So it was the full thing. It was his looks. It was his personality on and off the stage. And it was that voice.
I just
want to play a clip of him singing, because he would hit these high C's, which is one of the reasons why he's considered the greatest tenor of all time.
The king of the high C's.
The king of the high C's, he was dubbed. And this is a clip of him in a Donizetti opera called La Fille du Régiment at the Met in 1967. And here he is hitting 9 high C's. I mean,
wow. I know, it's unbelievable. I mean, here in this interview, the hairs are going up on the back of my neck.
Yeah.
We really tried, when we were mixing it, we mixed at Abbey Road to try to make it a great sort of sonic experience for audiences as well. The incredible thing, too, about opera is, again, you know, I mean, if they're doing a concert or something, they can use microphones. But when they're performing an opera, no microphones. And they have to have the power to deliver that kind of performance and create that sound, and it's all them.
It's really remarkable because, as you say, he was dubbed the king of the high C's, and yet he was still so insecure about his singing. He said, "I go to die before every performance," before he went on stage. Like,
well,
really nervous.
That surprised me because, of course, you assume that at a certain point he's going to have like the confidence of karate, you know, master or something. But then again, I've been around a lot of very talented people, and I know that insecurity drives them. And I think a lot of it has to do with something they have in common with Pavarotti, which is a respect for the medium, a respect for the audience, a respect for their craft, their talent, and the possibility that this opportunity could be met and they could do something really, really great for the audience, or, you know, they could miss. And I think as long as that possibility of underperforming is there, I think, you know, for people who set the bar so high, that insecurity is just something they have to live with. Maybe it even fuels them.
Let's talk a little bit about his personal life, which was pretty stormy.
Pretty operatic.
Yeah, I guess everything is a big appetite in many things. So he had, he was married and he had 3 daughters with his first wife. And he had affairs with assistants, including one he married, Nicoletta, who he says was the love of his life, but that was kept secret. And then when the tabloids took photos of them, I guess cavorting in the surf, that really was a big problem for him back in Italy.
Well, you know, of course, especially in Italy, where divorce was a no-no, and certainly as it related to, you know, sustaining a career and the dignity of the family and all of those things. So it was that it was, you know, incredibly painful for everyone when that story broke. Yet late in his life, when he was on his deathbed, it very moving for all for us doing the interviews to hear everyone talk about, you know, putting that pain aside and coming to be there and to pay a visit. And the thing that they all had in common was a spirit of understanding or acceptance without forgetting, but this forgiveness.
So, yeah, you have these home movies that Nicoletta made, and at I think it's Nicoletta, she's off screen, asking him what he wants to be remembered for. And he doesn't really say for opera, he says he wants to be remembered as a good father.
Well, he sort of has regrets. He sort of he says he kind of wished he'd been maybe a better father. He'd like to think he was a good father. You know, I mean, it's a very interesting and I think revealing moment. And I think he set the bar high for himself in a lot of ways that maybe didn't always live up to his own sort of expectations for himself, perhaps.
Later in his career, he decided to do these concerts with rock stars like Bono.
Right.
And he they were called, what was it called? It was Friends.
Pavarotti and Friends. Pavarotti and Friends. Well, at a certain point in his life, he discovered philanthropy, not just as a sort of a thing he could do here and there and lend a hand or something, but something he would take the lead in. And Pavarotti and Friends became you know, a passion of his, along with a bunch of a number of educational programs and so forth. But he would recruit pop stars to come and sing with him and do these duets and so forth and so on. And it did accomplish two things. One, it you know it paid real dividends on behalf of the programs that he was trying to support and bring awareness to, and it also broadened the awareness of opera. And he was always trying to democratize opera. He grew up in you know in a small village where it was popular entertainment, and he took his role as a kind of an ambassador for the art form. You know, very, very, very seriously. So I think he was accomplishing a lot of things when he began working with those pop stars. But man, he took a lot of grief for it, a lot of aggravation for it. And you know that hurts.
And who was criticizing him?
The press, the media. You know, those from within the, you know, the conventional opera lovers. But it had more to do with the media, critics and so forth. And he knew that was happening, and yet he continued to pursue it because he felt like it was better for opera, better for the programs he wanted to support, and therefore what he would choose to do, even though it wasn't, you know, strategically the safest path to follow. To me, that shows some guts.
Let's just hear him and Bryan Adams singing O Sole Mio. So when he did a concert like that, or when he sang with someone like Bryan Adams, he wasn't singing with them to say, oh, look at what a great singer I am compared to you. He really wanted to form this connection between opera and rock and pop, like connect these two musical worlds, right?
Yeah, I don't think he saw them as you know, distinctly different. They were different disciplines, but I think that was fun time for him. And I do believe that he felt he was, you know, bringing opera to people who might not have otherwise considered it, and hoping, you know, hoping to engage them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
A pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Take care.
That's Ron Howard talking about his new documentary, Pavarotti. It's in theaters now. Ma che mistero è la mia vita, che mistero, sono un peccatore. And Warren Olney is here now to tell us what's on To The Point, the podcast.
I got a lot to tell you about. We're going to do a piece on abortion. Is Roe versus Wade in trouble? We all know what's going on in the southern states, the effort to really put an end to abortion. We'll talk about that. We'll have a special on next year's California primary, the Democratic nomination in particular. Will California have a really important role this time around for the first time since 1972? And on our climate change update, can the president revoke climate science? We got a lot.
Warren, that sounds great. Thanks so much.
Okay. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I'd have said the right thing, but it must have used the wrong.
Dr. John's right place, wrong time. And that's it for us for Press Play for this week. Our producers are Michelle Aloy, Alex Trigfototter, Rosalie Atkinson, Rebecca Mooney, and Adriana Cargill. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Taw is our digital producer. Mike Stark engineered. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. And don't forget, you can always podcast Press Play wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'll see you Monday at noon. Making itself clear.